Right. Well, the attorneys are finishing up getting ready. I will call the second case. The second case is State v. Is it Shelburg or Chelburg?
Kelberg.
Kelberg with a hard K. State v. Kelberg, case number A23-1295. Good morning, counsel. As I know you are both aware, you will have 15 minutes this morning for your oral argument, and appellants, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Before you begin your argument, you missed my intro at the beginning, but this is being live streamed and there's an audio recording. No other recordings are allowed of today's hearing, and the audio recording will be posted within 24 hours. Because it's an audio recording, if you could please identify yourselves and your client for the audio record before you begin your argument, we would appreciate it. And both of you should feel free to take the time you need to get comfortable up at the podium before you begin your argument. So, with that, counsel for appellants.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Melvin Welch, W-E-L-C-H, on behalf of Appellant Brian Kelberg. Your Honors, I identified in my brief three primary areas. I'm going to focus for most of my argument here on the first one, which is the prosecutorial misconduct. It is, at least in my experience, maybe not this court's, it's rare we have a case with such clear facts. In this situation, much of what was captured at the time was observable both from objective evidence of a doorbell, one of those ringing bells where you capture video of people on the stoop from across the step. There was the actual assault on the appellant, which we began while he was on the phone with law enforcement. And immediately thereafter, the retrieval of the phone as the decedent left the location after having been injured, and relaying to law enforcement what had just occurred. And then there was a statement given in close proximity to the time thereafter to law enforcement by the appellant, which was corroborated both by the objective evidence as well as a subsequent statement that he provided to law enforcement. So there's not a lot of ambiguity that exists here. What is especially egregious about the conduct of the prosecutor here is that it injected race as a consideration immediately. One of the first arguments made by the respondent in the opening statements, or one of the presentation of facts in the opening statement, was the allegation that, and the insinuation that my client had hurled a racial epithet at the decedent in defense of his property. That was a theme that permeated the questioning and ultimately in closing arguments.
Well, I suppose it depends on how you read it. Your way of reading it is that he was hurling this racial epithet. As I understand the state's way of reading it, you're saying the state's way of reading it was using a racial epithet. And I think from reading their briefs, it's like, well, no, these words were said, they're relevant facts, so we're gonna talk about them. So are you suggesting they should not have discussed the circumstances that arose that generated post-parking dispute? I don't see what was so wrong with the state doing what they did.
Understood, Your Honor.
So why am I wrong?
Well, what I rely on in making this assertion is the state's own words. So in the closing argument by the young prosecutor, she identified how they perceive these words to be. Yelling is provocation, I think the precise quote here, Your Honor, if you give me a moment. It may take me a moment, but to the extent of it, it's in my brief. Yelling is provocation from a white person to a young black man. Using the N-word with a hard R is provocation from a white person to the decedent. So I'm not intuiting what the respondent's perspective and presentation is here. They articulated it clearly in their closing argument. Their argument was number
one. I asked sort of a, I guess, question that I think that the state argues that part of why when we got to closing argument that there were arguments made with respect to race was because the defense introduced race as an issue first during opening statement. Do you agree factually that that's sort of the order that this happened? And does that affect our analysis of the closing argument?
I don't agree. And I think that the transcript is clear on it. Number one, it was made in the opening statement by the prosecutor. I think it was transcript page 162 or 163, where they identify that he was yelling at the decedent using the N-word with a hard R ending and without context, which the context being that my client, when asked by law enforcement, what was the order of occurred? And it's very important that the accused be precise in this. This is information, and this is a presentation of that information by the appellant that indicates actions consistent with innocence. He doesn't hide anything. He doesn't try to obfuscate. He doesn't try to provide additional context. He provides precisely what happened. I was on my property. There was a vehicle that was illegally parked there. I contacted law enforcement. I contacted a tow. Individual came on. I said, please don't come on the property. Stop off the property. Don't come on the property. The video shows him approaching the appellant. And then ultimately, appellant pulls out the phone to call law enforcement. He's attacked. He doesn't have any opportunity to run away. And ultimately, that's another argument that the
well,
state
this,
is that
I mean, this
flee.
Comes to my question, and this goes to the motion for judgment of acquittal. And I know that you didn't want to focus all of your time there, but I see the district court in denying that motion that they said the jury could have found the provocation was not letting the decedent move his car, as opposed to this exchange that happened, who said the N-word first, that the provocation could actually be something earlier than that. Why did the district court get it wrong?
Well, in that particular finding, Your Honor, I would that was addressed a little bit in the brief regarding provocation, at least in the use of words, has to include some element of force. So that was, can't remember which case it was off the top of my head. It was a situation where the Supreme Court was being asked whether or not self-defense applies to a disorderly conduct situation. And it was analyzing the facts of that case where the accused had grabbed the other individual, or the victim had grabbed the other individual's coat, which was an act of force. And there were words used, and the defendant was attempting to assert the defense of self-defense at trial, and the court said, no, you can't do it, it's a disorderly. And Supreme Court said, yes, it can. There's an element of force that's being used here. So when the court said,
well, if you have to have an element of force, then why would it matter who said the N-word first?
Well, because that was what was asserted by the state, that was the basis for the provocation. Their argument was that use of this racial epithet in these circumstances were the provocation for the defendant to lay hands on the appellant, to strike him in the face four or five times, knocking his glass several feet away from him, knocking him down on the ground.
I guess I'm just not understanding the difference. And maybe what you're saying is under either theory, it doesn't matter. But I guess I'm not understanding the difference between the district court's finding, which is the appellant was, by his conduct, not allowing the decedent to use his car or to get access to his car. And that was provocation, as opposed to hurling a racial slur. Like, neither of those seem to have sort of the physical aspect of it. Both of them are more body language or words. And so do you see a distinction between those two? And maybe your answer is no, because neither of those can be provocation in that.
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. That would be my answer. Neither of those is provocation. The evidence that deduced at trial, and that which is supported by corroborating evidence of the video and otherwise, is that Mr. Kelberg, the appellant, did not approach the defendant, that Mr. Kelberg informed him he was calling law enforcement, that Mr. Kelberg was not in front of the door.
I mean, the record autos, am I mistaken? I thought there was testimony that he brought the tire deflator, because if the cops were we're not going to move the car. He was going to deflate one of the tires.
There was a statement he provided, Judge or Judge Conley.
So, I mean, he wasn't just waiting for the cops to show up for the tow. I mean, and the cops weren't going to show up. So it sounds like he was getting ready to do something on his own.
Well, the testimony was that he later learned, or that was learned at trial, that law enforcement was not going to respond because of the low priority of the call. There was knowledge.
Look, my point is, he had this device in his hand.
Pocket.
So, you know, it wasn't just, well, I got my cell phone, the tow is coming, I'm going to call. I mean, if it was, then why would he have this device? Except he was, you know, I think a reasonable inference was, well, he was going to use it. So he wasn't just sort of, you know, peaceably waiting for the police come to tow the car to, you know, uphold his rights, you know, about the parking, which I understand he was upset about.
Well, the information we have regarding the tire deflator was that it was in his pocket. It wasn't in his hand, wasn't visible, and it wasn't until after he'd been struck several times that he reached in, pulled it out, and utilized it. So there's no indication that he had.
Yeah, but I mean, just, you know.
Sure, but we're looking
why
at
why would
intent.
You have a tire deflator unless you were thinking of using it?
And he admitted as much. He said that he was looking at deflating the tires who were parked in his lot, but he didn't do that. So at least to that extent, I think it's indicative of what the testimony was regarding peaceful nature and the fact that he does not look for conflict and otherwise. So it's consistent with the character evidence that was introduced by the defense in relation to him. But the error that occurred here, and this is where I think the district court swerved off track, is you're dealing with two different standards of self-defense. We're dealing with the self-defense of property and we're dealing with the self-defense of self. In the self-defense of property, there's no indication in either situation that he is acting in any physical manner to preclude the decedent from entering the property. There's no physical action by Mr. Kjellberg in obstructing his way. The testimony, the evidence appears that he was just off to the side of the vehicle, and certainly Mr. Or the decedent could have accessed his vehicle at any time, but that's not what happened. What happened is when he pulled up the phone, he was attacked physically, and he had no opportunity to retreat at that point. So when you're looking at the question of, all right, what is a responsible or what is a reasonable amount of force to be used in response, we look at the individual size, we look at the propensity for violence, we look at all these different factors, and those factors there would tend to support, and I would submit to the court, do support without detraction by the state's case, that Mr. Kjellberg was reasonable in acting the way he did, especially given the fact that he had a prior traumatic brain injury and was advised by medical expertise, if you get hit in the head again seriously, you're at risk of dying. So there was a risk of death.
What are we to make of the fact that there were no visible injuries on your client? I mean, the problem I have with the arguments on the motion for the judgment of acquittal is, the jury heard your client. They saw the evidence. He did not have visible injuries. And I understand, your arguments about, he was shorter, he was overweight, et cetera, et cetera. But, the jury heard these arguments, and based on assessing the credibility, decided to convict your client. And I guess I'm hard pressed to see why we would reverse that as a matter of law. So why am I wrong?
Well, firstly, Your Honor, I would submit that one of the errors here, Your Honor, not the full of errors, I don't mean to insinuate that.
No one takes umbrage at pointing out my errors. Believe me, it happens every day here.
Firstly, there is evidence in the record detailing the injuries to Mr. Kjellberg. So there are photographs taken of his side, of his face. There are statements from law enforcement.
I looked at the photos. It didn't look that bad to me. I mean, what I was looking for was, the bloody nose, the black eye, the cut lip.
Sure.
Someone who's being beaten up.
Sure.
And I didn't see that. And I'm wondering if that's what the jury didn't see either. And then at the end of the day, we're presented with, most people can resolve parking issues without killing someone. And that's what happened here. And apart from the whole, you know, language issue, I'm just not so sure that, well, I don't see the error as a matter of law that the jury made. So why as a matter of law, should we reverse this conviction and instruct the district court as a matter of law to enter a judgment of acquittal, which is something we don't do a lot here?
Well,
why would we do it in this case?
So that's my one argument, right? That the district court erred and that judgment of acquittal ought to be entered. That may not be my strongest argument. My strongest argument here is that there was error. There was race injected by the prosecution. And I would argue to the court here also that the record in the making the argument, which the state does, that there's no evidence of injury. Well, that's not true. There were injuries to his head. There was a redness. And though it wasn't exorbitant swelling within a short period of time after the injury, because that's when the pictures were made, there was observations made by law enforcement that there had been strikes around the head. And that anytime you're striking somebody around the head, you are putting that person at risk. An individual struck in the temple can be killed far more easily than an individual struck in the mouth, although the mouth may be more visible than an individual struck in the temple. And in this situation, there's also objective evidence supporting that he was struck in the head. Glasses were knocked off. They're on the car several feet away from where he was struck. So the evidence does support that he was, may I finish? So the evidence does support the information that he was attacked by the decedent. What's of greater error here, and I think that the case law supports this, is that when the state purposefully ignores evidence that is apparent in order to make arguments and inferences from that evidence in the absence of others, that is error. There is a responsibility that the state has to acknowledge the facts that are in front of them and to not ignore them. And that was done here by the state. They ignored the fact that he was struck first. The objective evidence indicates that he was struck. They ignore that. They argue in their closing argument that he never was even attacked, despite the fact that there was evidence of such. So there is a curating of the narrative by the prosecution in a time where there is exceeding race hostilities and appealing to those race hostilities, which was why there was the issue related to the Schwartz hearing, in order to procure a conviction, which is not supported by the objective evidence. And I'll thank the court.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondents. And you can certainly adjust that if you would like.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Alexandra Meyer, and I represent respondent the state of Minnesota in this case. There are a few points I wanted to make about appellant's brief and his argument just now. First, on page 13 of his brief, he describes the prosecutor as, quote, repeatedly asking questions regarding the timing and use of the racial epithets by the decedent. And I would invite this panel to look at the specific portion of the transcript, which is page 468 and 69, at the questions and what the prosecutor was trying to accomplish there. He is establishing that the appellant had no clear memory of the order of events. And he highlighted these discrepancies between the two interviews, the on-scene interview, the station interview, and his testimony, to say there's inconsistencies in what he said happened. Therefore, we don't know what happened. So the questioning was not in any way related to the racial epithet so much as what happened, at what point were you punched, what was said right before you claimed to have been punched. Second, I would point this court on the argument of whether saying a racial epithet is enough to be provocation. While it's a...
Do we even need to get there based on the district court's findings? I mean, the district court, I mean, the way I read Judge Castro's statement is that he said the provocation started by not allowing the decedent to enter his car, which would mean that the provocation occurred before whatever verbal statements happened. That would have preceded those verbal statements. So do we need to get to whether the verbal statements were provocation?
I do not believe you do. And I think that's referring to the third issue. My point was back on the first issue.
Well, and I do see and I can address both. Like somewhat, I think that one thing that I've been wrestling with in this case is that if the theory of provocation had to do with not allowing him to have his car, then was the conversation about race really necessary? And is there a tension with respect to some of those arguments that were made at oral argument? If the basis for denying the motion for judgment of acquittal was that the provocation occurred before that. And I guess if you could respond to whether you think that there is any tension in that analysis, and if so, how you think that should be resolved.
I don't think there's any tension because the only, apart from the surveillance video, which if you've listened to it, it's very hard to understand. Apart from that, the only facts that the jury was presented with was what appellant told police. And that included his repeated back and forth of at what point racial epithets were used. And I think that was relevant to the jury's understanding of this altercation. So I don't, while the judge could look at, for the purposes of a motion of judgment of acquittal, when the provocation occurred, I don't think there's a tension between that and the relevance of what appellant claimed in his interviews had happened during this engagement.
So what is the evidence that supports the N-word with a hard R statements? Because I watched this video, and this video is not crystal clear. And the audio is maybe even worse than the image. And so, you know, what was the evidence that was presented at trial to support the statements regarding the N-word with a hard R?
It was entirely appellant's statements. And the state wasn't arguing necessarily that appellant said it first, but he said it, even if he only said it back to Mr. Stewart, that's enough under the state's theory at trial to escalate the situation. And I would point the court back to the Scarsella case, which is non-precedential, but is one in which this court said that, at least for purposes of the jury instruction, using that racial epithet is enough of a provocation in that case to Black Lives Matter protesters. So context matters.
I will be candid, having been somewhat familiar with the Scarsella decision, I'm not so sure it stands for the proposition you want it to stand for.
Well, then luckily for me, it's non-precedential. I believe that was the only case that really addressed this. And so the point of that is this is not plain error. There's nothing that says you cannot argue that that would be enough to provoke because there's no case that says it doesn't. So even if it was error, it would not be contradictory to the law.
How do you respond to appellant's argument here that the case law actually provocation requires some kind of use of force?
So I think there's a distinction, and I may not be able to give you the exact pin size. I think there's a distinction between who the first aggressor is and who does a provoking act. I don't think they're the same legally, and the jury instruction uses both words. So there is obviously a distinction, and the state was not as strongly arguing he was the initial aggressor. He's arguing that he was he was provoking this. This was escalating something that had no need.
So to Judge Larson's excellent point, provoking how? By making a big deal over the parking or by using the N-word?
Both. Both are somewhat outrageous.
What was argued by the prosecutors at trial?
They focused on whether it was an act honestly in good faith. So they kept, or she, the prosecutor, kept looking back at this whole scenario. His response was not honestly and in good faith. And one of the statements she pointed out is that he, in an interview, said, appellant in an interview said, if he had been more personable, I would have let him take his car and leave. That's an outrageous statement. That's like, if he was nicer to me, I wouldn't have needed to do this. And so the jury, looking at that, that's not an explanation of how he was acting honestly in good faith in this entire situation.
So they obviously had to have a theory of provocation. What was the state's theory of provocation?
I believe the state's theory at least as expressed in the closing argument, was the racial epithet. Okay. But then the judge looking at it and having heard all the evidence could definitely decide what the jury, what the evidence demonstrated was that the provocation occurred well before that. I don't think those things are inconsistent.
Why wasn't Judge Castro's limited Schwartz hearing error?
I think Judge Castro went over and above what he had to do legally. There's a case cited in my brief that says the depth of the Schwartz hearing is up to the judge's discretion. And here, the judge allowed a hearing where the state believes he did not have to. There was no prima facie case made, but he still said, sure, let's find out if there's something here. He subpoenaed three jurors. One, I think, was injured, and so they canceled that subpoena. The other two were subpoenaed. JF came in and was questioned. And Judge Castro, in his discretion, asked these questions, got these answers, and nothing in there triggered any further need for inquiry. I believe it was beyond what, it was a very careful decision, and it went past what would have to be done most narrowly and looked to make sure there wasn't an issue, and there wasn't.
In applying the circumstantial evidence test to the motion for judgment of acquittal, do we need to rely on the video for the facts proved in terms of who did the provoking, or can we rely on the appellant's statements?
So under the first part of the circumstantial evidence test, you're determining the circumstances proved in deference to the jury's verdict. And the video is something the jury saw. It's very difficult for this court looking at it to know what they
It's not a saw. Great video.
It's not a great video. So you have to look at, with their verdict, they obviously did not see in that video what appellant told them they should have seen, or what he said happened. By rejecting his claim, they obviously saw something in the video consistent with him acting unreasonably. But I agree, it makes it very difficult. And I think the way that Judge Castro looked at it was...
I think that the way we do the circumstances proved can often be really challenging because, we're supposed to assume the jury believed the state's witnesses and disbelieved appellant's witnesses, but it does seem somewhat like the state was relying on appellant's statements for proving some of the elements. So therefore, is it your position that those statements are part of the circumstances proved for the purpose of the motion for judgment of acquittal? Or do you think we don't look at those statements?
It's difficult here because I will acknowledge the state looked at or presented two versions of what appellant said, but they did each time by introducing evidence that it was inconsistent, that there were differences between them. So the fact that the state used the evidence doesn't mean that the jury had to look at that evidence and accept it simply because it was introduced through the state. The state did not have a witness. It introduced a statement. I guess their witness would have been the police officer who could talk about how the interview went and the questions the police officer asked, which were, frankly, very skeptical.
In the circumstances proved, did the state prove that the decedent said the N-word first?
I think you have to...
Do we have to, based on the evidence that came in at trial, is a circumstance proved that the decedent said the N-word first? Since that's the only statements that we have, and I think that you've admitted that the video is not probably going to clarify that factual point.
I think we have to accept as proved that the N-word was said. I don't know that we have evidence that he said it first or didn't say it first. We have enough evidence that it was said, and the jury could decide how that happened within the context.
But you don't disagree that there's not nobody else got up in this, the 911 operator didn't get up on the stand and say, I heard him say the N-word. I mean, we don't have any evidence other than his statement that the N-word was said.
Yes, because Mr. Stewart couldn't testify. All he could go do is go back to his friend's house and say, this person stabbed me. And the jury had to determine how that happened based on the evidence that was presented. And the prosecutor's use of the statements established that it was inconsistent. They were inconsistent, that he didn't remember exactly what happened, or he wasn't willing to say exactly what happened. And that really throws some question into whether or not he was telling the truth. And the jury got to decide that. And Judge Castro wasn't going to be in a position to say they didn't get to do that. So he properly found that there was no basis for a judgment of acquittal because the jury got to make that determination. This was all about credibility of the appellant and his version of what happened. If there's no further questions, I just ask that the court affirm appellant's conviction.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And I would be interested in your response to the circumstances proved. Given our standard of review, we have to look at the facts in the light most favorable to the verdict. And so with respect to that, how do you think that we need to look at the introduction of the statements that your client made?
This is the pickle, Your Honor. And actually, I was only going to get up to address this one point. The respondent said, you know, the evidence that there was a question whether or not he said it first, right? The repeated questioning related to this racial aspect of the trial that was repeatedly inquired about by the state at the case. We have evidence whether he said it or not, but we don't have the evidence. We only have the evidence that it was said and that the jury can decide within that context. Here's a problem with that. If there's not evidence that exists to support a jury determination, then there's a problem there. And when there's not evidence to support an insinuation or to support an assertion or the injection of race as a consideration in the trial by the prosecutor, that's not only clear error, that's serious error. And so this is such a tragedy, but also a very interesting case, since we deal with both of those, is that the sole information we have here is from the appellant, but we have this external evidence, though it's not great. It corroborates the details. It corroborates his relaying of this information to law enforcement, that he was there waiting for law enforcement. He was approached, that he was approached as he backed up. It corroborates that he was attacked when he was on the phone and he was struck. So that's.
But you don't disagree that the video does not resolve who said the N-word, right? Like there.
No, I agree.
There's nothing in the. I mean, this is what I've been struggling with respect to our standard review and. You know, what we have, I think you're right. The only evidence that we have in the record is that he said the N-word first and that your client responded with the N-word. And there isn't really any competing evidence with that. And I don't think that the video shows one way or the other when that happened. And so I guess that when we are applying our standard review, if that's the only evidence that comes in, is it your position that we need to say the jury believed that version of events? Or is it your position that we have to say something more general in terms of the circumstances prove that the N-word was said at some point?
Well, with the review of circumstantial evidence and accepting evidence that's in, that is favorable to the jury verdict and excluding all others, I would say it's not provocation. Right, legally, that it's insufficient for the jury to found it to be provocation, and any argument that it was provocation would be erroneous by the state, which was uncorrected by the court, which case law says should have been corrected. So that was not sufficiently corrected, and that was a problem. But secondly, it is a dilemma, And unfortunately, I don't know that I have a sufficiently, I mean, my argument.
Well, I do think it's a tricky thing with regard to how we do circumstantial evidence.
Well, I'm going to argue on behalf of my client, right? Yeah. But I'm trying to think of a truly manner we approach this, knowing our standard of review. And that's why this is so peculiar. The state had to adopt a theory of prosecution, and they did so by injecting these racial considerations, which were that the defendant, an old white man, antagonized a young black man, number one, by yelling at him, number one, by using the N-word with a hard R. The only evidence that was done and that was said was from my client, who provided all this information to law enforcement, whose information was corroborated. So the only evidence we get to in looking at it circumstantially is his statement, is the corroboration of his statement. And for the jury to have come down in a position antipathetical to that, they would have to have adopted some facts, allegedly, inconsistent with the only evidence that was introduced at trial, pursuant to the state's theory. And that's where the error happens, the serious error. And that's where the serious error cannot be unattributed, or where the verdict cannot be unattributed to that serious error. And ultimately, that is why we ask this court to reverse the decision and return it for new trial. If there are no further questions, I thank the court.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel in this case. The case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion in the time prescribed by statute. With that, we end our oral calendar this morning, although I do think that we have some interns from Judge Quam. Are you present? Hello. Do you want to step off the bench briefly?
Whatever you want, Judge Lewis.
Do you want to step off, or are you comfortable? Okay, so with that, we'll adjourn the court session, but we are going to stay up here so that we can chat with the interns who are present in the courtroom today. Yep.